This is Radio Wivenhoe, and it's almost time for Wiv Chat, your Sunday evening date with Jason Cobb at the Onion Bag Blog.
Okay, Wiv Chat here on Radio Wivenhoe, and I've got another guest. We're going to explore a few local ideas about why my guest is here in Wivenhoe, which is going back some time, and general thoughts about the town and how it's changed. So it's a name and a character which I guess a lot of people listening are going to be familiar with. And so Martin Newell, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Good. Without fireside chat, and it is a fireside chat.
Yes, we're by a fireside. Fire is not lit, I must add, listeners.
A starting point, the first question. Yeah. So Martin and Wivenhoe seem to be linked going back some time. I'm never really quite sure. Should we try and clear up, Martin? So when did you first come to Wivenhoe and what did bring you to Wivenhoe?
Well, I first came to Wivenhoe in summer, possibly May or June of 1973. I'd seen the place before that because I was only living in Great Bentley up the road where my mother and father were living at the time. Well, my mother still is living there. But I didn't really, Wivenhoe was just a stop on the, and I always thought it looked nice. Then one day, a friend of mine, Richard, and he had another friend called Sam Hurd, who was one of four children of an artist called Michael Hurd, said, we're going out to Wivenhoe to see Sam's dad. And I thought, well, it's on the way back to Bentley. So we came out here and I think we went to the station where, the thing I remember about Michael Hurd is he was balancing a pint glass on his head. You know, it was so my introduction to Wivenhoe was like that.
And some things don't change, no.
It's still a bit like that.
If you go to the station tonight, you might find somebody down there.
You might,
a pint glass on the head.
Exactly.
So this was probably just a random teenage or kind of young male moment, and you probably didn't think, I'm going to be in Wivenhoe 30 years later.
Oh, no, I really liked it. I mean, I always liked Wivenhoe. I mean, if anyone ever said, oh, do you fancy coming over to Wivenhoe? There was something I liked about the place. And I came, and then I started going out with a girl in 1975, and she was living at Station Road, right a couple of doors down from the station, and I thought, oh, that's okay. And of course, I was spending more time here than because the station was my default pub, even when I still drank in the Ship on East Hill, which is where I was living at the time. By that time. And I just thought, oh, we'll go over and visit Julie, or we'll go over and she's near the station, and what could possibly go wrong, you know? And in the end, I just started spending more time here than I was at East Hill, which, strictly speaking, I was only house-sitting for someone.
So then it just really made sense that you kind of found yourself, by mistake or by default, living in Wivenhoe.
Well, I kept trying to get away from the place because I got given this really, not given, but I got to rent this really smashing place in Ayton Road in Colchester, which I was there for. I was very good at looking after people's houses, you see. That's what I was good at. And I was, in a rock band some of the time and washing up dishes. So I was always around. I never went on holiday anywhere. If I wasn't on tour, I was here. And I think it was 1979. Peter Brightmore of Station Road or West Street, because his house was in both places. And I was out of a place having split up with a woman. And he said, I've got a room, but you can only have it for 3 months because I'm doing out the whole house. And I ended up looking after the place for years. So I've never I came back to Wivenhoe something like the third time, and this time I never moved out. So I have actually officially been resident in Wivenhoe since May of 1979, which is, I think, over 32 years now.
And what was the town like then? Because had the whole kind of bohemian effect, which I think is overplayed, but was it a very, very different town then, you know, kind of culturally, professionally, the people that were around?
I think it was a working town. Above anything else, it was a working town, full of working people. There was a shipyard, James W. Cook's, which your interview with Peter Green, you know, reveals. I couldn't remember the name of the people before that, but it had been a shipyard for 150 years and probably before that. And there were boat builders, and there was a fishing fleet. It was already slightly depleted, but there was a fishing fleet. There were several boats, and there was a maintenance dock. And the place was still a bit tarry, and there was a dock. and Meredith's Woodyard, where the ships came in from Scandinavia. And the Hythe was still a working port, and certain Roehedge had docks, so the ships came down the river, and so as well as our own working chaps. And to see the guys coming out of the shipyard on a winter evening, the old beat-up cars and the mopeds, and the guys in greasy overalls who'd finished a week's work in the shipyard, coming past the chip shop in the dark, and to see the guys coming out of the docks, that actually existed at night. Very often there would be a ship from Hamburg or Rotterdam or even further afield had docked in, and the crew would be, you know, in the pubs.
And what kind of effect did that actually have on the town? So did it mean that it became, I wouldn't say like a multicultural town, but was there this kind of sort of transient sense?
Yeah, well, in a way
on?
It made it a slightly more cosmopolitan place, I think, than it is today. These were working guys, but they got on well with our working guys. I mean, I don't remember a constant series of punch-ups. You know, you'd get a bunch of stokers in from Hull or something like that, and they'd look a bit old-fashioned at some of the remnants of the glam rock generation like me, and they think, well, that bit rummed over there, you know. That. But, they'd soon find out we were just working guys too, and you'd end up having drinks with them or whatever. Yeah, there was very rarely any trouble of that sort. Yeah, but I mean, it was a rough and towery place, and you would get the odd punch up. But usually it was between local people and over local matters, which you tended not to inquire into.
And who were some of the characters, if we're not going to really incriminate people, but are there kind of names or faces that you know that were always kind of ever present, you know, during mid-70s, late-70s, people that you'd see out in the different
There's
pubs?
An entire ghost parade of people that I could probably send past you in a slow-moving tableau. There was Gail Cross, Gail and Roy Cross, the artists. I mean, when they first came here and they came up from Chelsea, well, Roy was from Liverpool and he had taught two of the Beatles, Stuart Sutcliffe and John Lennon. He taught, that was his legend, and he was a good artist. And Gail, who even in 1979 was still quite a glamorous woman, she had been a beautiful Chelsea girl, and the two of them were, you know, he was kind of like a Johnny Cash, who was dressed in black and his hair back like that. And they weren't posy or anything, but they were described, and not unjustifiably, as the Burton and Taylor of Wivenhoe in their time. And there was Michael Hurd, a former army officer who'd come up from Cornwall, I think. And the Dans, John Dan was, Pam's still alive, you'll have met her, but John was an extremely good ceramist. Or ceramicist, I don't know, well, you know, but well, he made pots. He was good.
Potter.
And Dr. Dean, who I worked for, and better still, who you never met because you wouldn't meet her in a pub. That's how what opened Wivenhoe up for me when I became the village gardener for a while, or one of them, because there weren't enough to go around, there were never enough gardeners. And I gardened for Mrs. Alice Green and Dr. Dean, both of whom knew each other, both of whom were octogenarians nearly by the time I met them. And both of them were just full of stories, fully marbled up and full of great stories, which I remembered or wrote down.
And why was it, Marty? Why do you think that these people then came into the town? Because Wivenhoe now is not a secret. And, you know, I think in Essex and also going to London, people, it is really quite a desirable place to move into. I'm guilty of doing this myself, and I'm very, very happy here. But, you know, in the sort of 70s, 80s, do you think outside of the town, Wivenhoe was like known as this place where it could be, yeah, quite a nice lifestyle here?
No, I think that's a recent thing. The kind of vague poncyness that's overtaken it, and people, you know, the Guardian and, the Guardianistas and the Londoners and things like that. I mean, one thing, I think it's always had an artistic population long before before the university got here. There were artists who lived here. It's the light, but it's all down the East Coast. You would find that in Malden. You would find famous artists in Malden as well. Wivenhoe, trumpets itself quite loudly. There are as many artists in Roehedge, I reckon. But there were artists here beforehand. And, you know, I think there is something. It's one of those Regency places, and it really was. You know, it's one of those places that's got a predominance of Regency buildings. And it's like Bath or Brighton. It is going to attract, and probably always has done, slightly peculiar people. But they would have to live on the terms of the people whom they'd moved in amongst. And I think in this case, they've slightly overwhelmed them this time. I mean, this is not a caricature. People think it's a joke. I was standing outside the post office a few years ago, and a friend of mine went cycling up the village, you know, with a box on his bicycle. So, and a woman who I know to be a weekender from Hampstead at the time just said, "Oh, look, there goes one of our colourful local characters now."
So you sort of mentioned these like terms of Wivenhoe, and you've got to really try and sort of fit in with that, or at least make an effort. Is there any sort of defining thing? What would you define as being the sort of character reference or term of reference for old Wivenhoe? I guess probably something linked down towards fishing, shipping, sailing.
Well, it was farming, and it was fishing, and it was boat building. We built the fastest cutters on the, well, probably in England, and the Essex fishing fleet was rapacious. When they ran out of fish here, when the oysters started getting a bit too popular with tourists, they'd just go and take somebody else's, or they'd go up to Terschelling, you know, up on the Frisian coast there, or they'd go and have the Welshes. And the only people who beat them off was the Scots, who, you know, fired blunderbusses and threw bricks at them. Just sort of fun. You know, no one else successfully beat the Essex fishing fleet. They were a hoary bunch of old buggers, they really were.
And this must have been really quite an interesting time, so...
Chuff cookies had a very hard life. You know, the mortality rate was high. Yeah. And, you know, people died.
And then it sort of just seems, so moving on slightly, sort of through time, kind of going to the early 80s, and sort of mentioned with the shipyard as well. But then, under Thatcherism, what was Wivenhoe like then, you know, and in particular with the miners' strike, which I gather you had quite a... large involvement.
Well, I became involved in it, yeah, but Wivenhoe was... Wivenhoe was quite solid with the strike, I think. There were people who disapproved of the miners, but I think that transcended any left-right issue. It was whether it was fair or not. I mean, it split the Tory party. I remember Harold Macmillan, Earl Stockton, seem to remember him throwing up his hands in Parliament at quite a great age and saying, you know, what are you doing to these men who got us through the war? And then some curmudgeon in Wivenhoe said, actually, they went on strike during the war, but they didn't all, and they were the Bevan boys, and they had fuelled the, you know, the stuff that got us all the metal and smelted this stuff down, and the coal that burned it. You know, they worked hard, and they'd been promised that the dubious right that they, their sons, and their sons' sons, and their sons' sons should have the right to remain underground in these filthy, dusty conditions. And their communities were based on it. And when she just went and closed those mines down for the sake of expediency and got what was his name? MacDonald? Ian MacDonald, was it? A Canadian bloke of Scottish extraction, to close them down. She closed communities down, and we're still reaping that horrible harvest now. And that's not a left-wing thing, but it was unfair and it was very bad for England. It was a thing that England should hang its head in shame over, what, the mines, because now, you see, other things have transpired, and they've got, I don't know, I'll probably get myself in hot water here, but there is such a thing as clean coal burning technology, and I think we could probably be a little bit more independent of those Russian gas magnates if we had thought more. Because once you've closed a mine down, it's kind of very expensive to reopen it.
So what was the role specifically in Wivenhoe during the miners' strike? What took place here? What kind of scenes?
People, no, well, there was 2 weeks. There was 2 weeks where we were actually the front line, where the miners came down, and someone who knew the NUM here phoned them up, because what was happening was the port owners were importing cheap Polish coal. So the NUM guys got onto Lech Wałęsa of Solidarność, and he said, right, we'll stop this. So then the port owners started importing South African coal, mined by poor wretches in South Africa who were being paid £1.50 a day. This was like a red rag to the bull, to the miners and to the left, and suddenly the whole of, you know, the spotlight and the front line moved to Wivenhoe for about a week or 10 days. So a similar amount of policemen moved in, and there were punch-ups, and there were lots of big pictures, and it was on the news every night. And then the battle shifted further upfield and it went to Orgreave.
And did it change the town, do you think, or was it just one kind of passing moment?
Well, it did change the town in the end, or it helped, it contributed to it, because after that there was a port for a while, and then no more port, and then the port lay dormant for a while, and then they built the houses on it.
So almost the sort of Wivenhoe situation, really, it just really replicated what you've been saying about.
I think the 80s was where, well, the 80s anyway, somewhere around between the battle, somewhere between the Russians going into Afghanistan and the Battle of the Beanfield was when the real change took place, although it's kind of hard to explain it, and then it accelerated very rapidly sometime in the mid-90s. It lay dormant for a while, like a sore waiting to break out. Then.
And it probably accelerated here on the ground in Wivenhoe in terms of the developments. So it just really just seems to summarise perfectly that idea of traditional industry, manufacturing, disappeared. In its place, we have housing.
That happened all over England, but you know, my dad always used to say, he was a Port Health Authority, and he was at Harwich, but he used to say, the trouble is, I mean, this is what it is, the old boys died out. Them good old boys died out. And them good old boys knew a couple of three things. They'd know, for instance, that there'd been a pig farm at a certain place, and there might be slurry underneath it, so it'd be no good building there because the foundations would go. And the same, as I was amazed to hear Peter say in an interview, that he thought it was, you know, he never got to finish, but no one interrupted him, but he got sidetracked. He said, you know, he said, what if they keep on building houses up the river? And he said, rather chillingly, oh yeah, it's going to be a very dangerous thing. And then he was just about to say why, because you do not build on a river. And the arrogance and incredible temerity of our developers, who just think, well, we've got new piling methods now, so of course we can build on. You don't build on a river, you don't build on marshes. And those old boys knew that, and the Saxons knew that. Everyone down to the Saxons knew that. I wouldn't buy a new house on a river. I'd buy an old house on a hill, like you have, which I did.
But houses still are. Houses really are still appearing almost overnight down there.
They have. See, they seem to have exceeded their brief, because I just thought there was permission. I understood that they've got permission for X amount of houses and that was it, and there's still stuff going down there. I'm thinking, they've got to stop somewhere. Who's sanctioned this? Who's organising this? Who's dealing with the infrastructure for the roads, which only take horses and carts? And who's dealing with the drains? I had a horrendous talk with a drain specialist visiting from Cambridge one night in the Greyhound, from another area. The expert always comes from far away. And he was getting hammered, because I think he'd had a row with his wife, so I just sat there listening to him and casually answering questions and trying to remember what I could. But he told me some horrendous stories about the state of the drains up in the woods, where, you know, things were floating about because they hadn't calculated that the clay shrank in hot weather and, you know, expanded at other times, and pipes tended to move about. I think they've got a few bog problems down the bottom there in one of the estates, I shan't say where.
So having new people coming into the town and living in these new developments, walking around and sort of drinking in pubs, is this like a next phase? So you sort of mentioned the sort of artists coming in. Is, in your experience, has there been something kind of transient where the town has changed?
Just something really good about what's happened, because, you know, there were people who were curmudgeonly about the new. Them new houses, old people from London moving in, and that's not going to come any good, is it? But the fact of the matter is, I always thought, if you get a proportion of people moving in, yes, some of them will just kind of come and sleep here and occasionally have a meal here and wander around. But a larger number of them, people such as yourself and other people, will bring their energies and their talents to the town. And I think it's undergoing a major rejuvenation. It isn't what it was, but it's better than what it has recently been. And all you have to do to confirm that is to go and look at the post office or the news agents to see a foliage of leaflets of things that are going on, exhibitions, classes. You know, we're kind of majoring in art and part-time education. Never mind if the university has become a kind of private institution for educating the rest of the world's students, because our own can't afford to go there. Well, they'll become irrelevant soon. The fact of the matter, all the people they've disenfranchised are now educating themselves or being educated by people who've been made redundant. So what you'll end up with, actually, is a kind of free University of Wivenhoe. You won't get a qualification, but you'll learn stuff. I think that's really good. And the art, the radio station, the music,
The cinema.
Yeah,
all that.
It cannot be a bad thing. It's got to be good. And if people come here and think this is lovely, that's good, and spend their tourist money, that's also good. But if they think, You know, you can't, we're full, like Tom Roberts, the mayor, said, we are full. We have to accept, either a few of us are going to move out, move over or die. I mean, give it, I don't know, 20 years or more or less, maybe, given my drinking habits, I could die, I could move over, someone could move into my house. That would be nice. But the children of, a lot of the children of Wivenhoe couldn't afford to live here.
Hmm.
That's bad, isn't it?